I'm joined by the amazingly talented Chris Cornell from Soundgarden. How are you going, Chris?
Good, how are you?
Very well, thanks, mate. It's an absolute honour and a pleasure. I'm going to get straight into it. The difference between 92 Soundgarden on the road and 2012 Soundgarden on the road.
There's a really good chance I will remember 2012 Soundgarden on the road. 92, I remember sort of kind of blurry images here and there.
It must have been an amazingly heady time to be coming out with a bunch of bands that have went on to shape the music of the 90s, the Nirvanas, Pearl Jams, Alice in Chains, was it?
I don't really have a timeline either when I think about it like that, because we were just writing songs, recording, touring, and there's probably about 7 or so years that just blur together.
Yeah.
You know, there are no winters, summers, anything like that. It was just one long kind of writing, recording, and touring process. And it became sort of cycles, but where it was easier to sort of figure out, you know, where our memories come from. Because that part gets hard, too. It's like this is only the third time we've been to Australia, but the first two times that Soundgarden came, the memories from the first one and the second one sort of blur together. It's hard to, I can't remember like which bands played what and what happened. We all had a great time though, so you know we know that, and so hopefully this is something we'll be able to do coming down here more often. You know, only doing it twice is kind of embarrassing for the amount of time we were together as a band. We should be able to do it more often.
So is this refreshed? Do you feel like are you just vibing on the energy up there on stage, all you guys together again?
Yeah, it's really fun and it's different, you know, and it's, I'm kind of, at first I was sort of relearning to play the songs, period, and be able to sing them, and now I'm kind of trying to, you know, move on, you know, and let the music evolve.
Uh-huh.
And then we're going to have an album of new material that we'll have to, of course, figure out and play live, and that will blend in. But our songs are always evolving, kind of, in the context of live. It's never the same approach live as it is on the record. We have a lot of layering and sonic stuff going on, and it's definitely stripped down when it comes to live performance. And then the songs, as we play them over the years, they kind of change. And we got busy right away doing that sort of mutating stuff and also playing songs that maybe didn't get much play before we split up. And now we play them a lot more. We were known for putting out albums, too, that there'd be, you know, an hour and 20 minutes or whatever the maximum amount of time can fit on a CD was on there, you know. So there's a lot of songs and there's a lot of stuff that we haven't played. So, yeah, I look forward to going out and doing this a lot.
And I think it was Miles Davis who said, if you play the same song the same way every night on stage, you're already dead as a musician.
Yeah, we've never been able to do that. If we rehearse more than like 2 weeks for a tour, we get worse because everyone gets bored. But somewhere, the best that we get is somewhere in the middle of tour when we start to get a little bored and then the songs change and no one plays them the way that they're written anymore at all. And then there's a period where that's great. And then it can sometimes go too far out, though. Usually a good thing, but not 100%.
Now, the reviews from the social media on the Big Day Out shows have been absolutely raving. Do you feel like you're not only... As you say, you've only been here three times. You feel like you're not only playing to your fans, but you're getting this whole bunch of new fans coming into you?
The Big Day Out shows feel like, like a lot of young people that obviously weren't even around when we came here for the very first time. So it's strange. There's some people looking at us with new eyes, and then there's actual new eyes looking at us, which is great. I think that in some way rock music should be out of time always. It shouldn't really matter what era it comes from. I don't ever remember thinking of that much when I was a kid, kind of unearthing rock bands and buying their records and trying to find stuff I'd never heard of. I remember being a kid in Seattle when we discovered AC/DC, because Seattle played them on the radio early on, because it's a good rock city. So the radio would play good rock bands, even if they weren't huge yet, and we didn't know anything about them, and we had to buy AC/DC records at the import store, So it was, you know, at the time it was $20 for an LP, which was a lot.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
There was $5 for a normal record. But that's what we did. And I feel like there's a little bit of that now with Soundgarden. Like there's some 16-year-old rock fans that are sort of discovering what we do and kind of going back and listening to the records and figuring out who we are. And I like that feeling, that sense of you've got people watching you that have found you based on kind of your history as opposed to you're the latest thing,
yeah,
or you're part of the latest thing.
Yeah, the bands that I was mentioning before, Mudhoney as well, Pearl Jam, mm-hmm, Nirvana, that must, being a peer group with those guys must be pretty amazing in that, you know, you say, yeah, when you're doing it, you're just part of it, aren't you? It's like, it's not, you don't think about it, but.
Yeah, when it was happening, it was sort of what we knew. We knew it was weird and special that that, uh-huh, was happening, but it's easier looking back and, like, I'm proud of all of those guys. I was at the PJ 20 Festival in the summer and Mudhoney played on that show. And they were incredible. Like they were just, if I had never heard them before that day, which was a few months ago, and just walked up and heard them play, I would think they were a phenomenal band. And I wouldn't know where they were from or how long they'd been a band or what. I just think they were amazing.
Yeah, right.
And we knew all of those guys from very early on and from previous bands, because everyone was in previous bands. Soundgarden's the oldest one, really. Everybody's contributed a lot to the history of rock music now, and you know that for a fact now. Mm. Looking back, we're not speculating; it's true. And if I hear a Nirvana song on the radio, it doesn't sound like old music or dated music or anything. It sounds like it could be a band that did it tomorrow or yesterday or whatever. I feel like you can actually say that this is part of rock history now and be right. And I'm really happy that we're part of it.
Now, in keeping with that, did you ever have like a "fuck me, we've made it" moment? Was there a "this
not
is it"?
Not really. Soundgarden didn't really have that because we started really slowly and then toured a lot as an indie band all over the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and driving our own van, moving our own amps, that kind of thing. You know, we'd have like one crew guy. And everything just slowly but surely was always moving ahead for us in a good way. There was no overnight success of any kind or unanimous success. You know, we always had a little bit of a fight in front of us. We were never going to be, like, unanimously loved. Because part of what we do is just, it's hard for some people to get on board with. Sure. And we still have that. But that was also what I felt like always set us apart. So, you know, we were always happy with that. But, there was never a point, I don't think, where all of a sudden it seemed like, oh, my God, we've done this. To me, it was almost like 2 years after we split up where I was listening to the radio, and I think it was in Seattle, and the song Pretty News came on. And I don't remember what it was in between. It was like in between Tom Petty and some other rock band, but it sounded by far the best of the three songs. And it just dawned on me that, oh, we've graduated into classic rock.
Yeah.
Like, people will listen to this music now for a long time. And that was probably like the closest thing to like a high-fiving myself moment of,
right,
wow, you know, no one can take that away.
And I mean, with the recording process, as you say, it becomes a big blur. One minute you're recording, then you're on tour, and then you're, yeah, doing big festivals and stuff like that. How is it different now? Are you using your time more wisely in the studio?
Well, now it's a little different in that we've been actually touring. So we've been playing shows and or touring in the middle of writing and recording. So we didn't have just this one long constant period of writing songs and then recording and mixing and then getting ready for a tour. And I think that's kind of good.
Mm.
I think it's good to sort of sit with the ideas, sit with the demos, sit with actual recorded versions. And, you don't have this rushed perspective. We haven't changed anything because of that. You know, no one has run in and said, we got to change this song because I've been listening to it for 6 months and it's wrong. You know, we haven't had that.
Yeah.
But still, it feels less rushed, and it feels less like the business of music is more important than the actual records. And that's kind of what happened to us. We were lucky in the sense that we were around during a part of where the record business was still possible, which it isn't anymore. So in that way, we're lucky. You know, that's why we have sold so many records. But at the same time, you know, there would be people penciling in tour packages with us to support an album we hadn't even written the songs for yet. I hated that.
I've been a rock fan, been in bands all over my life and stuff, but towards the end of the 80s, rock music became a bit of a parody of itself, and everyone was laying them, you know, Motley Crue were driving around in 20-meter long limos with spa bars in the back and stuff. And what I loved about you guys and other bands of your ilk that came out of Seattle was there was a lot of speculation that the media could come up with, but you guys weren't just you maintained some mystique about the band, whether that was just because you didn't give a stuff about telling those people the personal facts of your life. But I found it to be a really great time in music when the music spoke for itself.
Yeah, I think that all the other stories that people liked to tell about rock bands were sort of groupie stories, like mud shark stuff, drugs, alcohol, and it all been kind of played out. And we weren't really from that scene. We were kind of from the post-punk indie scene, which there were people with drug problems. We drank a lot, things like that, but that wasn't part of what we did, really. It was just, you know, it would have been something we would have been doing if we worked for the Postal Service. Or something. It didn't matter. So it wasn't like a badge that you had to wear in the post-punk indie scene. It was something that actually sort of would more likely put you in a group with bands you didn't want to be put in a group with. So we stayed away from a lot of that, partly because of that and partly because it just wasn't, I don't think it was us, and most of the bands that we were surrounded by, it wasn't them either. And it could only be a good thing, I felt like. You know, if when people talk about your band, they're talking about something other than the songs or the music or show, then there's probably something wrong.
Yeah.
You know? Either you're not good or you've become famous based on some kind of a lifestyle thing or good publicity, I suppose.
And you've lost along the way some contemporaries of yours, Lane Staley, Kurt, obviously. The first time I think I heard your voice was a Temple of the Dog CD. Was that a tribute to a friend
to
of yours,
Wood, yeah.
Andy Wood? Yeah. And that was when I first heard your voice and Eddie's voice at the same time. Those collaborations, do you ever think you'd like to do some more of those? Or
well, that. Audioslave happened because of that. Oh. Really, I mean, that was what I had in mind when I got a call from Tom Morello. I really was specifically thinking about how much fun I had doing Temple of the Dog, and I had told myself back in whenever it was we did it, 1991 or 90, that I wanted to always be open to collaborations and not be closed off to it and not be preoccupied with genres or anything like that. Always be open to music as fun and as creativity, as opposed to a business or anything else. So I am still affected by that, and I'm always open to those kinds of ideas. And you know, music should be fun. Success in music should be sort of more of an unexpected kind of afterthought. You know, it's like a byproduct of what you're doing, and if you're lucky, that happens, and it is lucky, you know, and you're fortunate if that happens to you. But it shouldn't be what's most important. And media often goes there, you know. Generally, when a band puts out an album or does anything new, they will go right away. They will, before the album comes out or the movie or whatever it is, they will talk about how much they have to sell to kind of live up to the last thing. And they're talking about numbers and they're talking about commerce.
Yep.
And then oftentimes after something is released, they will talk about its quality kind of based on the concept of how well it did commercially, which one has nothing to do with the other. Something can resonate, and it can be of high quality and also resonate commercially. And that happens occasionally, but not that often. Most of the time when something is hugely commercially successful, it's crap. If anything, it's a sign that it's going to be crap, you know, because it has to appeal to a really big audience, which means it can't, you know, it has to not do too much, you know. It has to be very simple.
Right. Now, your solo stuff, what did you learn anything, you know, after 20, 30 years in the business, did you learn anything doing the solo, stripping back from the Soundgarden days and from Audioslave, going out there solo? What was that like?
Well, it's different. It's almost like a completely different medium, really. I mean, it's still music, but it's you don't have the power of a really loud, aggressive band or arrangements that support that. So it becomes much more song oriented. And then the fact that you're alone, I can speed up, slow down, stop playing, do whatever I want. And there's no communication really required or even possible. So it's a completely different animal. And I think it's been really fulfilling to be able to do that, particularly at a time when, Soundgarden is back together now, and we're touring and we're writing and we're playing. It's sort of the perfect combination for me, because I always did things like writing acoustic songs and recording weird songs at home and doing kind of solo artist stuff, and they coexisted before. But now to have it be completely like a one-man show, acoustic guitar and singing, or this really incredibly aggressive band, it's a really satisfying time for me.
Excellent. And talking of the aggression in Soundgarden music, that's what first time I heard, I think, Bad Motorfinger, I was just like pumped up. We used to pump it on the way to all our gigs and stuff. But the melodies you've been able that you infuse, that's your thing, isn't it? That's you just bring these beautiful melodies to these hardcore songs.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the end of the day. The first band I ever was really into as a kid, where music became important to me, was the Beatles, and I always felt like becoming a band in like the post-punk era, there was a certain creativity was a part of it, just like the 60s. Like, you had to be creative, otherwise no one would give you the time of day. What's the point? You can turn on commercial radio then. But I also always felt like that there's something really challenging about the melodies that a band like the Beatles would come up with. It's not easy. It's a lot easier to make noise. It's hard to do that in an effective way. And so, you know, I was always challenged by that. I always felt like at the end of the day, I would try to get some kind of melodic sensibility in every song somewhere that I could take away from it and feel like it was music, you know. Otherwise, music would feel like sports to me almost, you know, trying to get a ball down a field.
So you've got the album in the process of being made. Mm-hmm. Is there... can you look into the crystal ball and tell us when you might be coming out to Australia for a full-scale tour?
Well, the album will be out in the fall, so sometime after that we'll hopefully be able to come and just do a full-scale headlining tour.
Awesome, man.
Which will be the first one where we've played all of Australia and New Zealand just, you know, without being a part of a festival. But I think it's time that we did that.
Cool, man. Well, I can't wait. I'm sure everyone listening can't wait. I want to thank you for your time. Chris Cornell from Soundgarden, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much, mate.
Thank you.
Cheers.